interested in is the question of making some type of small-scale quantum system, which we know how to apply some standard tricks in quantum control to, and using that small-scale system to create some type of large-scale processing steps. And so the focus of this talk will be first talking about such the quantum registers, which are these small-scale devices, and how you can make a distributed computation with them. And then, as time allows, I'll go into some of the physical implementation stuff and some progress we've made in actually making one of these registers. But I'd like to start by getting this idea of a quantum register properly into your minds, and then hopefully asking and getting some questions from you as well about where we can go with it. And then I'll go into this example approach component. So the idea of distributing a computation amongst many registers is not a new one. Certainly not new, at least to computation. And the motivation for such a thing can be seen from two different perspectives. One is a technical perspective. It has to do with the difficulty of getting more and more qubits into the same device, same optical cable, the same dilution refrigerator. Here, for example, are two dilution refrigerator systems. They're both about man height, or woman height, as you prefer. And there's a difficulty that there's a limited cooling power in any given dilution refrigerator system. So as you increase the number of qubits that you might put inside such a system, you'll have to eventually go outside one fridge and into another. And you start to ask the question, how do I make this connection between these elements? And that's at a gross scale of distributed computation, in which you're trying to make a computation larger than an individual device can allow. And this hierarchy of device inside the fridge and then some type of interconnection is really reflecting the difficulty of taking a small-scale device and coupling it at long distances to another small-scale device. There's another component of this reason for distribution, and the other has to actually do with quantum control. So here's an article now from many years ago, in which it was shown that you could do, with 7 NMR qubits, a realization of the factoring of the number 15. And you'll notice this is the pulse sequences that they use, and there's a few pulse sequences here that are part of the logical sequence. But the rest of it are dynamical decoupling sequences, like Daniel talked about previously, and other sort of higher order decoupling sequences and refocusing sequences. And there's a huge amount of quantum control technology that goes into making this set of operations extremely robust with respect to all the standard control problems one encounters. Now, if you try and get more and more qubits into the system, you run into a certain frequency space and control space problem that you're trying to address, essentially globally, a fixed system size, but a size which has increasing Hilbert space. And to get that control, you have to keep increasing the division, the bandwidth division of your system, or increase the overall bandwidth of your ability to control it. So as you try to put more and more, for example, qubits down the bottom of the dilution refrigerator, you run into a bandwidth problem, that your control electronics have to become higher and higher bandwidth in order to be able to control a larger number of qubits. So these two problems, the control problem and sort of technical size problem, makes one think at least that an approach that gets beyond these problems would be quite useful. And the approach that we'd like to present is that of building a quantum register. So we're going to use quantum communication techniques between different registers. And the idea in quantum communication is you have a very failure-prone channel, which you'd like to distribute some entangled pair between. And these approaches are based upon ideas where the channel is very noisy, extremely failure prone, but nonetheless, you can still, in a sort of probabilistic sense, produce robust entanglement at long distances. In addition to this, I will posit that these registers have extremely good local operations, and I'll quantify that near the middle of the talk. And the idea will be very simple, which is to use these many local operations for a very specific type of purification, in which we improve upon the faulty inter-register operations at the cost of local overhead. Now, this idea is by far, in some sense, an old idea, and even in quantum computation, it's an old idea. 5 years ago, this paper by Oskin, Chuang, and Chuang indicates a fundamental idea in which one starts to take qubits in a quantum memory and separate them from a coding unit and logic unit. The idea being that individual registers here can be coupled via teleportation to each other, and I need not directly bring them in contact with each other. And this, I imagine, will be, I hope, review for everyone here, but the underlying primitive of all these approaches is the teleportation-based gate. in which one pairs an entangled pair, for example, between what I call optical qubits here, ones that can be connected by photons, and then with local operations with some quantum memory and local measurements, along with classical channels of communication, you can then create an arbitrary two-qubit gate between these two memory qubits. So if you can create this entanglement within some characteristic time of high enough fidelity, then you get deterministic gates out of this probabilistic entanglement mechanism, with the caveat that you must be able to repeat the attempt of generation of this entanglement enough times that you get it within the sort of overall time scale that you've given yourself to do the gate. And there's a side note here which is not really been remarked upon, and I will admit that in this work I'm about to present, it's not really exploited. And that is that this whole procedure of pairing entangled pairs and then doing gates between them has an interesting feature that you can often know far in advance when you would like to do a given two-qubit gate between two given qubits. And so you have the possibility, unlike in the classical system, of preparing entanglement in advance of the operation you'd like to do. And that gives you some interesting scheduling opportunities when it comes to preparing gates between distant registers that you don't have in a classical system. In a classical system, I have to wait for my bits to be processed before I can send them back to memory. And I have to wait for the bits to arrive at the register before I can do the gate between them. And here I have the possibility of actually preparing some type of bandwidth in advance of my use of it. And that changes some of the scheduling issues that one will encounter as you get to more complex architectures. But I'm afraid that for now, that's just going to remain a comment, which I would encourage questions about later. Instead, I'd like to focus on building this probabilistic entanglement in some semi-deterministic manner and dealing with the infidelities and errors that we expect in this register type architecture. So Chris Monroe gave a very nice talk showing how they actually were successful in creating ion-ion entanglement via photons. And I'd just like to review the photonic approaches to entanglement generation because it's critical to understand the underlying physical mechanism for this probabilistic entanglement generation in order to see how the register approach actually works. And the simplest example I can think of is one in which I have some emitter, which are given here in red. There's two emitters in this diagram. And the emitter has two metastable states, called them 0 and 1, which would be my qubit states. In addition, it has an excited state, which is, for example, an optical transition away. And via selection rules or energy selection, when I apply a laser to the system, I can do a pi pulse, which takes the 0 state to this excited state, but leaves the 1 state alone. So applying the laser, any population 0 is brought to the excited state, and then spontaneous emission will return back to 0 along with the emission of a photon. So if I start the system in a superposition of 0 and 1, when the photon gets emitted, it will go traveling in a variety of paths. One path will impact upon a beam splitter, where it gets split, going left and right, and goes either left detector or right detector. At the same time, if the photon were emitted from the right, the same process would occur. It would go either left or right. And if the two photons overlap properly, in this Hong-Lohmann-Del sense, then the resulting photon that can be detected at the photodetector here is indistinguishable. So I lose the which path information of this photon by interfering properly on the beam splitter. Now this is a weak excitation method in the sense that if I start with only small probability of being in the zero state, then after this event occurs in which I get one click on either side, I get with probability p the desired Bell state, and with probability p squared some error term. Some nice things about this. It's a weak excitation approach. It's extremely robust with respect to photon loss. That is, if I lose more photons, it impacts both the term I wanted, so it reduces the probability, but it also reduces the probability of two photon events, which lead to error. However, in addition, I really do need this good quantum memory, in the sense that while I'm creating entanglement, which can take many, many tries, for example, 10 minutes, if your system is a prototype incredible system, and hopefully more like 10 kilohertz once we get things really going. But nonetheless, it takes a very long time to generate this entanglement because I have to try many times. And that means that during that process, I need to have my quantum states that are to have gates applied to them be very robust. So I'm going to really need that good quantum memory. And this brings us now to the sort of minimal register. The minimal register consists of an octal qubit, which is the qubit that we use for entanglement generation. Now, it's actually very convenient, because this qubit is optically accessible, that we can also use it for measurement. Again, we have this possibility that if we go in a zero state, we cycle up to one and it goes back down to zero. This is a so-called cycling transition. And I can repeat that process many times and look for scattered photons coming from that single optical qubit, which is here shown in red. In addition, I'll need memory qubits. And the idea of memory qubits is that they are extremely robust with respect to the operations I might apply to this optical qubit. They have very good memory times, and they're qubits I can control extremely well. However, I don't actually need to be able to measure them or couple them to the macroscopic world except via this optical qubit. And so there's a sort of split of subspaces, if you will. There's the sort of microwave RF-controlled auxiliary qubits, the memory qubits, which are going to be extremely robust, very well controlled, but very hard to couple to the macroscopic world. And then there's going to be this sort of interconnect qubit, which is relatively easy to couple to the macroscopic world, which means that it's much more sensitive to decoherence. But it will also allow us to make the effective readout of these different additional memory bits. And the minimal register, as you may suspect, corresponds to the Goldie knocking those out of the way, and just having a memory and an optical bit. And it's minimal in the sense that if I can make high-fidelity entanglement only probabilistically, and the memory is perfect, then I can do arbitrary computation. And overall, the architecture you might imagine in this scenario is one in which I take these registers, and I take the single photon and put it to a fiber coupler, which has some low possible efficiency, and all of these fibers go to an optical switching network, along with photodetectors and beam splitters, which lets me produce an arbitrary topology of qubit interaction between these memory qubits via teleportation base gates using the optical qubits as interconnects. And I think actually there's an even more convincing picture of interconnecting different optical qubits via MEMS-based optical switches that Chris Monroe showed in his talk slightly earlier. However, this idea of just using memory and an optical qubit, where the memory is almost as good as you can imagine, and the optical qubit is your connection to the macroscopic world, turns out to not be sufficient once you allow for imperfections in this entanglement generation procedure and imperfections in the local control of these systems. So how do we deal with the imperfections? Well, there's two major ones I'd like to consider. One imperfection is the problem of measurement. That is, when I try and make a given measurement on this optical qubit, it fails some of the time. In fact, I'd like to consider a scenario where this optical qubit is so decohering that measurement fails about 5% of the time. So in that scenario, you can ask, how do I measure a given qubit? Well, rather than trying to measure the optical qubit itself, what I'll do is pretend that I have a state in the memory qubit I'd like to measure. And now I can use a standard bit verification kind of scheme in which I prepare the optical qubit with some probability of failure in a Z eigenstate. I use the memory as a control on a control knot, and I measure the optical qubit. I repeat this procedure 2m plus 1 times. And I can check all of my different measurement results and get some type of majority vote. The nice thing about this is that it exponentially suppresses errors that may occur along here. And in addition, the C naught, which teleports Z error, depth of memory, becomes irrelevant because I'm trying to measure Z in the memory. And so I have a very robust approach to dealing with errors happening in the optical qubit as long as I can do these C naughts with some high probability. Now, the other procedure one has to add is the possibility that when I make this entanglement initially, it's relatively low fidelity. In fact, most of these links of entanglement, the fidelity is hopefully better than that necessary to generate Bell's inequality, but probably not much better than that. So if something, for example, 90% fidelity would be a really good experiment. And so we can imagine a scenario which we're producing these entangled pairs, but the fidelity is only 90%. That means if I do a C0 gate here, the best fidelity I can hope for in that C0 is 90%. Now, to improve that to something closer to a threshold, as has been discussed earlier, I need to do something to improve the entanglement. And I can use now these techniques from quantum communication called entanglement purification, in which I take a given pair here, and via local interactions, I swap it into the memory, for example. And now I make a second pair. And I do a local operation followed by a measurement on this optical qubit. Of course, in practice, I'm actually going to need another memory qubit down here to do the measurements, because measurements are faulty. We'll come back to that in a moment. But in this procedure, the local operation followed by measurement with some finite probability produces a higher fidelity pair, which I call here an A pair. And the underlying operations here, you can imagine this is a bit of a confusing diagram because time here is going to the left and time here is going to the right. So I apologize. But the idea is I produce an entangled pair between these two qubits and another, I have a pre-existing entangled pair here. I can teleport errors on this pair down through the C naught and make some measurement about them. And that will help purify against bit errors. And then I can use the bit error purified pair to purify against phase errors. And in both cases, I'm going to use this robust measurement procedure, which is represented by this double box here and here. So putting it all together, I'm going to make some high fidelity entangled pair. Recall I needed one additional qubit to make these measurements, and I apologize for all the shaking of the screen. But I needed one additional qubit to make these robust measurements, so I have to add a qubit for robust measurement. And that would be great, I could stop there, except I also need a qubit to store the data while I'm making these highly entangled pairs, and so I'll have to have a fifth qubit here. So that ends up being the register that we propose. It's five qubits, one of which is optically connectable, four of which are memory qubits. And we're using a very specialized form of entanglement purification, or state preparation, if you prefer, to try and prepare a very high fidelity pair between these, so that I can do a gate between my data and some other data elsewhere via this highly entangled and high fidelity pair. And in terms of the overall picture, the point is, let's say I have some desired logical circuit I'd like to operate, in which I am trying to do, for example, CNOT, followed by CNOT. Well, what I'll do is I'll break this into pairwise gates, and I'll set some clock cycle time. So some possible things that can occur during the clock cycle time. One is that I can generate the entangled pair with high fidelity that I wanted to generate. Another is that I can have a did not succeed error, which I wanted to do a gate, but I couldn't, in the time I allotted myself, prepare an entangled pair. In which case, I would not do the gate, and instead record that I had two errors here. And then there's also the possibility, of course, that I did do the gate, but because my local operations are themselves not perfect, or the fidelity is itself not perfect, I still have a logical error. So essentially, you're breaking down the system into each of these time steps. In the time step, you'll try many times to prepare entangled pairs, and then you might succeed. If you're lucky, or if you're designing your system appropriately, you'll succeed within the time you've allotted yourself, and then you can do a teleportation-based gate and have it all succeed within some characteristic clock cycle. So part of the balancing act here is going to be trying to make this fidelity sufficiently high, but still take the time to be sufficiently short that I can have it all operate within the useful memory time of the system. If I can succeed in this, then I get an effective error model, in which, or a gate model actually, in which my time per gate is given by this bounded TC, and my error per gate is given by some effective error rate times the local operation error, because I'm able to purify against infidelity in entanglement generation and infidelities in measurement using these local operations. In terms of sort of the underlying formula, the idea is, for example, for robust measurement, if I take imperfect initialization and measurement to both occur about 5% of the time, then I can get near-perfect local operations. If I take, rather, near-perfect local operations, then I can get extremely high-fidelity measurements. Here's the actual formula. You can see, basically, I'm getting an exponential suppression of initialization and measurement error by this bit verification approach at the cost of linear overhead in local operations. And the overall timescale is essentially what I might expect from making an initialization local gate measurement with this overall linear free factor. So you win very big for this bit verification approach to measurement. And I should actually mention that I saw 2 weeks ago, I guess, Dave Weinland presented material which they were able to do this in an ion trap system, so that's kind of nice. And then the other aspect is the idea of robust entanglement generation. Now the problem with the entanglement generation is that these purification steps fail, and they fail quite often. That means that I can't just try it once or twice, I have to try it many times. And in fact, the overall time overhead you start to engender in the systems I'll discuss in the second half of my talk is on the order of 100 to 1,000 times local operation time. So you have a very large time overhead to produce these entangled pairs. But, But you can get very high fidelity pairs. For example, if I start with initial fidelity of 0.9%, of 0.9, so 90% fidelity, then plotting here the infidelity versus the number of purification steps that I'm attempting. So this is not how many steps it takes me to succeed, but how many attempts I make. So this is the actual overall time. And this is the final infidelity of the pair. And I'm not plotting the probability, but the point is we're actually having to work in a scenario where up around here, around 100 purification steps, the probability is getting to be more unity. In fact, of course, the probability has got to be bounded to be at least better than 1 minus the infidelity. And the point here is that when I have this good local operations, I get a final fidelity, which is about 20 times worse than my local operation rate. And that would give us an N effective of 20. So that means I'm trading off 20 local operations to make one good non-local operation out of a really lousy non-local operation. Of course, this time overhead means that a good quantum memory is critical for the success of any scheme of this form. If I do have the good quantum memory, such that my memory error during this characteristic timescale is below threshold, along with the final fidelity of the entangled pairs that I'm creating, then I can imagine using any of the standard quantum error correcting schemes, where these small registers each act as one physical qubit now in the entangled system. Some of my side advantages is that having a highly non-local topology, which is often a sufficient condition for the type of criterion we've looked at, though not necessary, as Chris Story has shown. But that this type of system allows immediately for very highly non-local topologies, so that's a very nice feature. But again, there's this problem of time overhead. And one thing that you can do is you can actually, of course, dramatically improve the time overhead if you can get more of the photons to the photodetectors. So for example, using optical cavities and using the Purcell enhancement of spontaneous decay into the cavity mode, you can get a dramatic enhancement, or reduction rather, of the amount of time it takes to make these pairs. It also improves the fidelity of the system, it turns out, because I can go beyond the single-click scheme that I described initially to the type of scheme that Chris uses, the two-click scheme, which purifies against interferometric phase errors and a variety of other errors. And that becomes also favorable. It turns out, for those who are interested, the turnover between these two behaviors is when your total collection efficiency reaches about 10%. So once I can collect photons and get into the detector to better than 10% of the time, I'm doing better with a two-click scheme than a one-click scheme. So I'm going to pause here to describe sort of what I've talked about already before I get into some example approaches, and I'll encourage questions at the halfway point. But just to remind you, the idea here is I'm trying to make something like a commodity good. I like these registers to be cheap, to be interchangeable, and essentially ubiquitous, because if we're thinking about the overheads of error correction, we want to be able to make almost as many of these as we can afford. And if they cost, for example, 1 cent per register, then we're doing pretty well. And if they cost 1 million per register, then we're not doing so well. So of course, this cheap part is actually only really relevant if we want to make large scale computations, but I claim it does become relevant at that point. Because we're using these small registers, we're reducing it out to a finite size control problem per register. And that allows you to think about doing a lot of techniques and tricks which are useful in the laboratory, actually on a production system, not just in a prototype system. And there's some nice examples of that, these great pulses of Naveen Kanesia and company using various feedback and filtering approaches and composite pulses. Another nice feature of this is that this optical or whatever other distributed qubit interconnect system you choose to use can be extremely faulty. And you don't pay a huge overhead except in time to have this assumption. And in fact, if you have less than 50% errors after post-selection, it's sufficient. And if you use this 5-qubit case, we need about less than 10% to get errors at the end that are 10 to the minus 3 to 10 to the minus 4. If you're at 50% errors, or just below 50%, which is sort of the threshold for purification, then you need more than 5 qubits, it turns out, to get efficient purification, or extremely low local errors. There's a few implementation ideas, but what we really need is basically a few couple highly controlled qubits with fantastic quantum memory. Ions come to mind. I'll talk about that in some other examples. And you also need something that's either optical or phononic or qubit bus interconnections possible. I happen to like bosonic systems, like photons or phonons, because they travel lightly, if you will. They're hard to interact with, except when you get a click. So they're kind of nice for this sort of long-range interaction. And some implementations I'll not talk about are ion traps and V-centers, quantum dots, et cetera. And there's a lot of improvements that can be made here. I mean, this is just a proof of principle idea. So, for example, you could use a much better approach to post-selective computing. There are some entanglement generation techniques which work with more than 2 qubits, which can be much more efficient at generating large Bell states that you might want, for example, for doing your universal gate preparation circuitry. There might be better purification protocols. In fact, it's known that n-bit purification can be better than 2-bit purification. And I think I mentioned this as an aside, but these sort of direct multi-qubit entanglement protocols may be a much better approach in the long run for making these type of devices. So this is certainly not the end of the word. Now, at this point, if there are questions about the register approach before I talk about some example implementations of this.
So have you looked at what happens when the gates that you're using are not perfect?
I'm sorry. I didn't mention that properly. The gates that I'm using have an error probability of 0.01%.
Okay.
So the local operation error.
So that's going to set a limit, but I guess it doesn't show up on your chart because it doesn't go down to 10 times.
Well, actually, the point is that this purification procedure is limited by local errors. Mm-hmm. And at 90% fidelity, it's limited to about 20 times local error rate. So as I improve local error rate more and more, then I reduce the final fidelity. So I'm sorry that point wasn't very clear. But the whole point of this procedure is that all the operations, initialization, measurement, and non-local gates, are limited only by a multiplicative factor in front of the local error rate. So you're basically mapping local errors into a new local error model at this overhead, and also an overhead in time. Any other questions about the register approach? Of course, we can take them again at the end. Yes.
Well, that sounds very familiar to me. There is a paper a couple of years old by Dirk Riegel and maybe another author who seems to do something very similar. Well, you have a bunch of qubits locally, well, do entanglement purification based on very noisy non-local gates and then purify. Are you aware of this work? And where do you deviate, if you know it? Where do you deviate from it?
I am somewhat aware of it.
Uh-huh.
I think the few deviations, one is that our entanglement purification procedure is actually specially designed in the sense that it minimizes qubit numbers needed.
Mm-hmm. I think they needed 3 or 4 qubits per site, something like that.
If I recall, they're not doing this sort of bit then phase purification, but they're doing intermediate bit phase, and that actually does a lot worse in terms of these rates. I think the other aspect that hasn't really been emphasized is this differentiation between optical, if you are interconnecting qubits, so things that have to connect to the macroscopic world, and memory qubits, things which can be separated out. So
I think it's exactly the same. You have sort of one of messing, or well, some guy that looks out and can be entangled.
Yes, yeah.
And then you have sort of these additional local guys that you use for purification.
Yeah, I think also, of course, the robust measurement approach, which is not that exciting. Some other things you might introduce, as we have here. But no, I think the idea of distributed computation is not that new or even that exciting. It's just I'd like to point out as a sort of a roadmap idea that if you can make these registers efficiently and make them cheap, then they really become useful in a way that at least I hadn't appreciated until we started working on the problem.
I mean, just a quick question. It's not clear to me how many distributed gates you can do at once, parallelism between different registers.
So that will depend a bit upon this interconnection system. And if one uses, for example, a MEMS switch with a CCD, then you're limited roughly by the number of usable, not bins, but sort of effective bin sizes on the CCD. So that can be several thousands to hundreds of thousands. However, in practice, there's a time element as well. Reading out a CCD takes some time. So using individual avalanche photodiodes like might be more useful. And then you're limited by the number of detectors that you have in your system. So it scales polynomially in cost, where cost is a monetary value. But what that polynomial is, I'm not certain. For example, we know with complex optical systems, usually as you change size, it goes to something like the size cubed. And so that would be a bit problematic, but I mean, it depends. So if there aren't further questions about the particular register idea, I'm going to talk now about some example implementation approaches. And this will just be a sort of a brief overview of how this register idea sits inside the larger implementation side, or experimental side, of the community. So the natural system for this approach is the linear Paul trap system, the so-called standard ion trap system. And the idea would be to take a linear Paul trap system and add to it a cavity, which interacts with one of the ions. Now, this cavity is just for collection efficiency, and it could be implemented in a variety of ways. Here's a few pictures from around the world of systems where there's cavity with ions in various types of trapping configurations with respect to cavity. So there is some experimental approach to this, and I'm not going to belabor this because, of course, I think everyone can understand ions are good memory. We know how to manipulate them relatively well. There's a lot of work in making those operations as good as possible. And if we didn't have to go beyond the linear Paul trap, wow, well, wouldn't that be nice? Another system, which might be a little less familiar, is the so-called nitrogen vacancy center. It's a color center in Diamond. It has some actually very nice coherence properties. The NV center corresponds to, here's the Diamond lattice about the carbons. Two of the carbons are bond. One has been replaced by nitrogen, and the other is completely vacant, thus a vacancy. This is an optical color center, so if you excite it with light, it emits light. And you can imagine that the electronic wave function here provides sort of the entangling qubit. It happens to have spin-selective cycling transitions, so it has this property that if I have like a zero, for example, I get photons. If I have a one, I don't. And in addition, this electron spin system, it's an EPR system, is coupled to carbon-13s that occur randomly in the lattice. And so you can imagine, if you're lucky, you'll get one of these NV centers with a few nearby carbon-13s, which can act as in-memory qubits. Now, this is a stochastic thing. You don't always get the ones you want, but when you find them, they stay where they are. They're trapped in the crystalline lattice. And the underlying idea here is that the carbon-13 is providing an NMR-based memory, and we actually have some non-experimental demonstration that the memory times are extremely long, on the order of a second. You're using the dipolar hyperfine coupling to the electron spin. And then you're using a spin orbit coupling to couple to the electric dipole to couple to light. And so this sort of levering up from nuclear spins, which are the best memory we know about right now, up to light, is a process that you actually control each step of the way. And that's a nice feature. And this has a more remarkable resemblance to an NMR molecule, but it's stuck in the lattice, and it's optically accessible. So you can work with single spins. So for example, here's a small picture taken through a microscope of a very small chip of diamond being illuminated by green light, and you get emission at 638 nanometers from NV centers. You can see here through narrowband filter a few different centers. If you look at one of these centers' light, you get a nice G2. These are experiments with the data taken by my collaborators at Harvard, Julia Childress and company. And this dip in G2 past 0.5 indicates that you have really a single center. G2 here is the autocorrelation of photons from the center. The center has just emitted a photon, can't emit another photon immediately afterwards. It has to wait to absorb light again. And there's also a spin-dependent component here, that if I'm in, so there's a triplet ground state, which has a crystal field splitting about 2.8 gigahertz. And when I'm in the zero state of this, and I apply light, I have a cycling transition, which emits photons. In addition, I can use a microwave field to drive oscillations between the zero and one. So this is ESR type driving. And in contrast, when I'm in the one state, I have a very weak excitation probability. And when I do excite, I have an interconversion to a singlet state, which goes back down to the spin zero state. And that is an optical pumping mechanism. So I can initialize the system in a zero state, and I get this state-dependent fluorescence. So I get photons out of the system if I'm in zero only. And that means if you pump the system to zero, then apply some ESR pulse sequence, and then apply light again, you'll get fluorescence only if you got in the zero state. And so you can, for example, do Rabi oscillations, in which you turn on the microwave pulse for a character of time t, and then look at the fluorescence of the system. You get beautiful Rabi oscillations back and forth. You can also do a pre-precession experiment, in which you prepare a coherence of the pi over 2 pulse between a 0 and 1 state, the weighted characteristic time t, and then do another power matrix pulse to convert that coherence back to population. And this beating here is due to interaction with the nitrogen 14 in the system. And you can also do spin echo, so one of these carp or cell type sequences, in which you prepare with a pi over 2 pulse at a coherence, wait a time tau, take another pi pulse, wait another time tau prime, and then a pi over 2 pulse, and look at the decay of the system. Now, something interesting happens with NV centers when it comes to this spin echo. And in particular, if you look at the underlying interaction Hamiltonian, I have a crystal field splitting, which is the largest energy scale in the problem at 2.8 gigahertz, and a Zeeman interaction of the electron spin with the external magnetic field. In addition, I have a hyperfine type that's actually a dipolar interaction between the different nuclear spins in the system and the electron spin. And it's this interaction, which Daniel wrote down as a sort of a spin system bath interaction, which leads to the decoherence that you might see. Plus, there's bath interaction Hamiltonian. Now, you know, I've only written BZ here, whereas this is a whole vector of magnetic fields, and that's because the XY components of the field don't commute with this large delta term, and they are suppressed to order 1 over delta. What this means for a given nuclear spin is that there's this S sub Z dependent field in the given nuclear spin C. So if there's electron spins in zero state, then there's no field from the electron spin, and the nuclear spin just sees the external magnetic field. But if the electron spin is in the one state, then it sees a field from the dipole of the electron, which can actually be very sizable compared to the external field. And this causes strange one-body dynamics in the echo signal, because my rotations when the electron spin is in zero, which might happen in the bottom half of the sequence, and when it's in one, which happens in the top half of the sequence, are non-commuting. That is, I produce a coherence, which is a sum of sort of one and zero, and they both do some rotation around this external field. Then I do a spin flip, and the electron spin flips its sign. So now I make a rotation of this type and this type for those two coherences. When I try and interfere those two paths, these non-commuting rotations destroy the interference signal. So rather than getting a standard echo recovery, one actually gets a modulation of echo, in which the probability of decays and revives as a function of time. And this happens exactly at the carbon 13 precession frequency, because of course when these precessions by an external field are too high, you get identity which can use. This allows actually one to do some type of local addressing in carbon 13s, because it turns out that the suppressed terms of order 1 over delta lead to a large G shift, so an effective chemical shift, which can be not on the order of parts per million, but in the order of 10 to 15. And I'm just going to sort of show that here. If you look at the diamagnetic ratio of some of the carbon 13s that are very near the NV center, they have a dramatically enhanced diamagnetic ratio of order 5 to 15. And this allows you to select out specially spins that are very near the center versus spins that are far away. And that's how you distinguish the memory from the back. And you can actually make a carbon 13 memory out of it. So here's some nice experiments by Gudrid Dutt and company, in which they started with by optical pumping and using this procedure to actually prepare a given nuclear spin state. They started with a given nuclear spin state and electron spin state. They prepare an arbitrary electron spin state. They make a mapping procedure using these non-commuting fields. And then they wait some time where the electron spin is just recessing, or sorry, the nuclear spin is just recessing, electron spin is traced out of the problem. And then they can retrieve a nuclear spin and undo the coherence. And so you can actually try a map of different various initial electron spin states, an X eigenstate, a Y eigenstate, a Z eigenstate, and see how well you can reproduce that after 10 milliseconds of waiting. And you see that you get relatively reasonable reproduction for a sort of prototype level experiment, where the storage fail is on the order of 75% here. Now, the echo lifetime of these nuclear spins is actually much, much greater than 2 milliseconds. As far as we can tell right now, our estimate is that it's about 1 second for just simple Carper cell sequences, and could get a lot better. There's some other directions that might be of interest. One is one that's very near and dear to me, and it spins in quantum dots, in which you use a two-dimensional electron gas structure, for example, along with metallic gates that are negatively charged. And those metallic gates provide confinement for electron spins, so that I can have little trapped electrons, which I represent here with small arrows, or if you prefer as a theorist, I can represent the electrons as small dots trapped in potential wells, and maybe one or two of them. And I can make a quantum bit, for example, out of the spin state of the electron degree of freedom. Now, the difficulty here in this register picture is how do you couple these electron spins to photons or phonons? And some options include taking this electron spin interaction and using magnetic field gradient to make an effective spin orbit interaction system, which leads to capacitive coupling to, for example, a microwave transmission line system. So I'm basically creating an electric dipole between two spins via a spin orbit type interaction. One can also think about scenarios in which you take these lateral quantum dots as I've described here, which I can make many of and put them together and control relatively efficiently. And in addition, one grows a self-assembled quantum dot in the system. And then one can actually get tunneling between these two systems. And the self-assembled quantum dots have a property that they're optically accessible. So they have optical transitions and cycling transitions, which allows you to connect to the external world for this quantum register type approach. There's some other interesting systems, for example, Wigner crystals of ions, that you can make a large plasma of, for example, beryllium. And you can actually trap it to the point in the, where you actually have a two-dimensional crystal. This is the top view and side view from John Bollinger's group. And you can do some interesting type of procedure where, for example, you use this as a quantum memory. You divide it into subregions, little subregions here and here and here. And then you might use a linear Paul trap system as an interconnect where this provides a quantum memory. And I use this because getting high collection efficiency in these crystals is extremely difficult because I can't get my optical complements very near the crystal without disturbing the trap. But getting a high collection efficiency in the linear Paul trap is almost demonstrated technology. And so you can use some type of asymmetric protocols between these two systems to overall improve your ability to make this type of register-based computation. So I'd just like to conclude by mentioning what I've talked about is these sort of few qubit registers. And they turn out to be sufficient not only for sort of simple level computation, but also for some type of robust computation. And there's a variety of applications in ion-based computation and B centers, possibly quantum dots, possibly neutral atoms. Superconducting qubits, I'm not as certain, though I'd be happy to hear people have an explanation how they could do it. And the fundamental idea is, again, using remote CNOS purification to make this high fidelity deterministic CNOS possible. And there's been some nice progress, as I hope I've shared, in sort of how you implement these systems, but there's still need a lot to be demonstrated. In ion systems now, Chris has shown atom entanglement. That's great. We need to get the fidelity up, of course. But for NV centers, for example, we haven't been able to show that yet. And then also, how do you get more qubits per node? Anyway, just like to thank my collaborators and stop there. Thank you. Thank you.